Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Hey everyone, welcome to Pop Culture Confidential. Emerald Fennell's Saltburn, which has been compared to stories like The Talented Mr. Ripley and Brideshead Revisited, is sexy, sweaty, hilarious, mysterious, and divisive. Its visual language is stunning, so I'm so pleased to have with me Academy Award-winning cinematographer Linus Sandgren. He's worked with directors like David O. Russell on American Hustle, on the Bond movie No Time to Die, and several projects with Damien Chazelle, including First Man, last year's Babylon, and La La Land, for which he won the Oscar in 2017. In Saltburn, Linus takes us on a gorgeous ride through Gothic environments inhabited by the British aristocracy, the Gothic corridors of Oxford, and the Saltburn Estate, a character in its own right. We talked about capturing the visual language of Saltburn, his inspirations, as well as that bathtub scene that has audiences gasping. Writer-director Emerald Fennell's last film was Promising Young Woman. Her new film, Saltburn, is set around 2006. Scholarship student Oliver Quick, played by Barry Keoghan, is attending Oxford when he befriends and obsesses about the wealthy and stunning Felix, played by Jacob Elordi. Felix invites Oliver to spend the summer at his eccentric family's estate, Saltburn.
My parents, they've got problems.
What kind of? What do you mean, problems?
I don't think I'll ever go home again.
Well, why don't you come home with me? Come to Saltburn.
Mr. Quick.
Wow.
And here he is now.
Oh, what beautiful eyes. Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, I told you it wasn't a minger.
Oh, but darling, you're kind about everyone. You can't be trusted.
I had them hang up an old school dinner jacket. We dressed for dinner here.
Dressed for dinner?
Yeah, it was like black tie.
I think I like you even more than last year's one.
You're so,
So what?
Real.
Welcome to the show. I'm so honored to have you with me, and congratulations on your beautiful work on Saltburn.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're going to steer clear a bit in the beginning from spoilers here at the top, but then I have some scenes that I'm so fascinated by your work and process into them. So I thought we'll delve into them later, but I'm going to warn the listeners about those when we get there. I recently heard writer-director Emerald Fennell say that she wanted Saltburn to, quote, make you feel freaked out and turned on. How did you start this? The key elements to do this visually?
Good question. I mean, you talk so much, right, about different things. And I always try to, you know, I really want to ground the cinematography and the visuals in the script and in what the director's vision is. And so a lot of discussions is going on that I try to not sort of project too many ideas, but rather ask questions so that we could create a language together. And that's sort of based on keywords that comes out of those discussions. And I feel like, you know, quite quickly we knew it was going to be a bold film that had, it could go like kind of expressive rather than completely naturalistic, even though it should all be real, right? It should feel real and should feel authentic. And it should, as you said, it should feel at the same time, all the time, there should be sexual tension at the same time as it could, you know, be whatever the scenes were about, it could always integrate some sort of sexual tension in it as well. So we started talking about it and came to sort of quite quickly the conclusion the film is kind of a, in a way, a vampire film, whereas vampire films has, you know, thematically or like metaphorically, I would say metaphorically, it's kind of a vampire film, I think, is what we felt that it should, the same way that has sort of desire and lust and sort of, there's also sort of in vampire films kind of violence and these things too. So we have all these kind of key, these kind of elements in it, even though it's it all takes place in reality. But and with that, it felt like also with the house itself being this amazing old manor that has these gothic elements, it all kind of came together as a mixture of, I would say, like Baroque paintings and like horror movies from the 20s, and like with a sort of voyeurism and suspense we were after, Hitchcock, and it was kind of all these things came together as one, like it they're all kind of related. So we wanted to live in that kind of realm of where you could see explicit things in sort of lit, sort of evocatively lit paintings kind of thing. So we kind of, yeah, we and also, you know, like Emerald really wanted to see a lot of details, a lot of sweat, a lot of close-ups,
armpits and nice things like that.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's, you know, like there's so much in pre-production where you talk, right? And you talk about these things and then suddenly you get the images in your head and the sort of the visual language, the visual style in your head. And I would say she also said at some time, she said like she wanted to feel like wet. And like that also kind of reminds me of the old sort of paintings from especially the Baroque era, I would think, like, which is like,
yeah,
kind of like Caravaggio, but like, yeah, Caravaggio and all, oftentimes these image or these paintings were oftentimes portraying things that were hard to really watch normally, like it would be scenes that would be perhaps hard to watch, but you would depict them in a sort of a beautiful way. And So it's always that contrast of beauty and ugliness as well, which was a theme for her too, to see, you know, both the beauty and the ugliness in things.
In several of the projects you've done my favorite thing. You've so beautifully and dreamily portrayed the heightened reality of LA and Hollywood in La La Land and Babylon. And now you're doing this heightened reality in something so British, the Oxford corridors, the rich estates, this property that you were talking about that's been in the same family for 1,000 years or what I think I read. What is the difference between that opulence in Hollywood that you captured so well and the British aristocracy, that fantasy?
Oh, well, I guess you need to research and look into how things really look like, right? And then pick the things that are specific. I feel like in La La Land, we also saw the sort of ugliness of LA, and it was kind of interesting to make it look beautiful, like because you have the beautiful light in Los Angeles, right? Like it's so incredible with the ocean right next to you. So the sunsets are incredible, the magic hours are incredible, and then you have this sort of the cheap part of the city, which is like the telephone poles or whatever, and the sort of gritty planning of the city. But if you combine those two, you sort of get something else that becomes that you could sort of romanticize that, and that's what we tried to do there, I think. And here we worked a little more. I mean, in the film, I feel like everything is very real. We've used real locations. It was very much about authentic, how things felt for Emerald at the time in 2007 or 2009.
Seven, yeah.
Yeah, in 2007, like how she felt things were back then. And and then we just turn it up a notch in dramatizing the lighting, dramatizing. Mm-hmm. We were always on relocations. We did build sets and stuff, but we wanted to just pick the things, the elements of this. So you have this rich, amazing castle, and it's sort of, or manor that is like a castle, and it's dark inside, it's bright outside. We sort of created contrasts like this, and the sense that the house was hiding sort of secrets, or secrets were hidden in there. And with Oxford, the same thing. All this college we were in, actually, I mean, it exists. It looks just like this. But we picked it because it had no modern looking sort of parts of it, which we liked. We liked that it had this sort of old fashioned room. So they felt a little more like a romantic version of, because I'm sure there's colleges there that are looking a little more modernized and have more modern windows. But we like the old gothic feel of it. We like that it had a lot of like sort of mullions or these bars in the glass that we could use for isolating Oliver in all kinds of ways. Like in every scene almost, we see these windows with bars in them, so that it feels like he's almost imprisoned in his dorm, and he's imprisoned in the sort of room where he's playing pool, and isolated from the others. And so we used, I guess, what is part of the thing, in order to make it a little more heightened and not completely naturalistic, is also to add metaphors and sort of symbols, symbolic storytelling. So that way, doing those kind of things and stylize it by compose the shots in a way as well, where it's kind of symbolic for each scene. So we worked a lot. We worked more that way too. I think in this film, me and Emerald, in composing the scenes and blocking the scenes in such a way that it wouldn't be. I mean, traditionally, cinematically, I would think we would do more shots and we would move more around and see different angles. But here, we kind of wanted to present to the audience almost like a painter would do. Right? Okay, if you paint one painting of this scene. Where is it? Oh, it's probably going to be here. And then you see the scene happen in front of you. The audience has the authority to sort of feel and see, instead of us sort of creating that for them. But you do as well, of course, but you rather with almost like a juxtaposing feeling.
So you were talking about the German expressionist type of thing. Yeah. You're using. I'm thinking of like tall rooms and ceilings and things like that. But at the same time, the family is always cramped in these little rooms, watching TV or the karaoke scene. They're always like right in the cramped in the middle there. But while you have this juxtaposition that you're talking about.
Right, exactly. No, but then also with that composition of this more square format, you see the tall ceilings and we cramped it together on the bottom. And I think when it comes to that sensual stuff that we're always wanting to add, it could oftentimes happen also in the close-ups, I think.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.
All right, listeners, we're going to get into some detail and spoilers now. One of the big things in the movie is, of course, that it turns out that Oliver is from a middle-class family, not a poor family. I wanted to know how you thought visually when you get to his parents' house. How different was that?
We talked a lot about it, actually, because it felt like that should feel like the most mundane, most normal, really. I mean, it shouldn't even feel like boring or ugly or anything. It's more like normal. And because to, I think, Emerald,
boring almost, I think, is what he feels about his life. It's more complex to be really poor or really, really rich, but this is just the worst. No. I think is his mind.
in his mind, there's nothing worse than be sort of completely normal and insignificant, and one of the normal people that lives a boring life has nothing. So this was the most sort of what he really wanted to get away from the most. So for us, it was about making the parents feel like really normal and wonderful and fine, and everything being quite sort of soft and naturalistic, but kind of boring, really, like not necessarily ugly, but not at all like any expressive feel to it, but just really plain. We even considered like thinking of maybe shooting that, because we shot everything on film, but we were considering for a moment maybe we should even shoot it like digital to just make
interesting, more, like TV. You know,
yeah, like a clean like TV image, but we didn't, but we wanted it to feel like just a normal mundane situation, you know, that would be the least exciting of all the scenes in terms of the look, you know.
And let's move on to the scene that's caused the most reaction, I think. I'm interested in hearing what you think of it, and that's the bathtub scene.
Yeah.
What do you think of the reactions to
So amazing. Every screening I've been at, it's really, really fun to hear the audience gasp, right? It's just like a... Like the full cinema, you know. It's just one shot, right? It's just one shot, but it's also that was also like, how can you tell this in the shortest or most efficient time? Not the shortest time, but the most efficient way, right? You always want it to be as expressive as possible in each shot, so that you don't need many shots to cut to. And we felt that we walked around before that. Once we were sort of, we had built the set, we walked around to find the exact angle. But what was nice was we found that if we have, when it was filled up, right, and it was all that red blood, then you could see the reflection of him in the water, in the bloody water. So that way we could rack focus to his face in the water. And
I was thinking more of the drain scene.
Oh
yes, that's the one that
I see. No, because I thought of the reaction in the that, yes. That was a big gasp. Oh, the other
also
one
also
big sexist. Okay, sorry. Yeah. The other the drain scene. Okay.
Yeah.
That's normal. I mean, that was no, but totally, yeah, that's like when half the audience were excited and half the audience were disgusted, I think. Yeah, that kind of and that was very specified in the script as well, actually, that scene. So mm-hmm. It was really fun to read. And we actually had two bathtubs for that, one for the sort of wide shot of it and one for the close-up, so we could really be down with him. So we cut out a bathtub in order to like be able to be with the lens right next to the drain. And yeah, I mean, that's all also like Barry and how Barry does that and Emerald's sort of vision for it. Because she really also wanted to just, we should really challenge the audience in, because to her, I think it's also like, it's both sort of erotic and sort of disgusting, just like the beauty and the ugliness. It's like, it's both.
Yeah, it seems like a theme going through. You're talking about the beauty and the ugly, yeah.
And everything can be kind of beautiful, but that's sort of the complexity of everything in life. But it's also for the audience to decide themselves, right? What they think.
Right.
Oh, there were many bathrooms that were exciting, actually.
Yeah, lots of exciting bathrooms in the Stolper. Yeah. And then I want to talk about the end, the dance. And I'm sorry if this feels a bit stereotypical because you're Swedish, but I think I mentioned it to you when we met briefly at Telluride. I was thinking of Bergman and specifically Fanny and Alexander and the Ekdal house, which is enormous and filled of statues and rugs and tapestry, and the scene where they, the Christmas dance, where they go from room to room and leading on to another one. And also that this movie is filled with dollhouses. I know you've talked about that. Emerald had this thing about, you know, when Alexander's looking at these, moving these things around. Thanks. And I'm not sure if this is all a reference for you, Maybe not, but is it?
No, it's actually not. We haven't really talked about Bergman when we talked about sort of references at all, actually. But when you say it, it's interesting because I feel like also it has a similar sort of, it also has, I mean, that's also some sort of upper class, right? And but the Swedish version.
And with the gothic feel of the priest, there's all these juxtapositions right in that. So,
yeah, actually interesting. Yeah, I think for us, for Emerald, the dance was originally also like a walk through the house, and it had to do with the beginning. It's sort of a bookend of the beginning walk, where we walk through the house and see the whole thing. And now it's obviously
it's his.
Yeah, he's the king of the castle. And it's kind of joyful, right? It's like, after all that we've seen now, it could also be kind of a bit gut-wrenching for people to see him sort of win or get what he wants. Like he got what he wanted, right? But it was meant to feel like absolutely joyful, and it's a lot about Barry's performance there, I think, too. The camera is kind of just following him through the house, seeing him being part of it, right? You wanted it to feel like he was part of it. And it's sort of a gentle creeping following shot throughout with an amazing score.
Yes, very much. In terms of Oliver, what methods did you use visually from the beginning of the movie to sort of half show us this double nature, the secrets that he was keeping? How did you work with that?
Well, I mean, one part is that already in the first couple of scenes, he kind of tells us, right? Like, actually, if you see it again, it's just like he tells you, kind of get the whole idea there. He talks to the camera. He says that he questions if he was in love with him or not. And then you see all these clips flash by from, and you kind of get a sense that something is wrong, right? And then, but it was a matter of unfolding and making him seem, once the film starts after that, it's like making him seem innocent and that he's a nerd and he's an outsider and he's, and slowly we sort of unfold that there's something awkward going on with him because he's right away kind of watching his friend Felix make out with a girl and he stands outside a window creepingly smoking a cigarette, which is sort of awkward and
ominous. And yeah.
Yeah. So now you sort of start to invest in him being some sort of strange psycho or something, or like having psychopathic issues. We're kind of intimately portraying him. I think we see him a lot in the film, and we're always curious to see how he reacts. Like we had close-ups on his face a lot to see, but he's actually lying, right? Like when he's crying in Felix's dorm, when his father has died, when he tells that his father has died, that is sort of like, we wanted to feel like really honest, right? Like he's really telling the truth here, and sad, and it's, you feel a pity for him. And so we wanted to invest in him for all these things, so that when things turn and reveal more of the truth of everything, you ideally have invested enough in him to like him that you feel like that you might understand him or something, you know. It's like when I play with these things. And as well, you have the character Farley, right, who's kind of annoying. So you kind of, I feel like I'm kind of on Oliver's side when it comes to Farley. But
yeah, because Farley feels like he's picking at him. He understands that there's something wrong with this.
Totally. And, you know. Yeah, no, he does. But also you kind of think he's annoying. So kind of root a little bit for Oliver in those moments with him. And then because later, you know, like even like when he has his birthday and where he has the birthday cake. That is kind of a black and white image, right? But it's red and yellow.
Yeah, it's like red, right? I remember that. Yeah.
And it's also like symbolic in the sense that that is sort of the heart of the house. It's the middle of the house. It's that staircase. And so it's like the heart of the house. So we thought like we wanted to introduce red all the time for all kinds of sort of symbolic reasons. Like it's connected with sort of lust. It's connected with death. It's connected to the inside of human body, and it's like it's a great color.
Period.
We had the blood. We had sort of the corridor between Oliver's room in the house and the bathroom is a red corridor.
Right.
For Emerald, that is a red corridor. So he walks through this red tunnel of almost like it's kind of erotic, I think, in one sense thematically.
You certainly are one of this generation's most respected cinematographers. You're doing groundbreaking work. When you look back at earlier generations of cinematographers, who really influenced you?
Oh, I feel like there's so many. I grew up, you know, like watching a lot of different films from all over the world because my dad was importing films to Sweden. So he worked with distribution and had a lot of films from like anything from Zhang Yimou and Kurosawa and Kieslowski to like Kim Jarmusch and like The Godfather. So it's like all kinds of films that I watched. They were all great. Most of them were great cinema. And when you see great cinema, it is great cinema, right? Like, it did really influence me. All kinds of different cinematographers. I mean, I hardly remember the name of the early cinematographers, you know, like when you go back to like Hitchcock or to like the 20s or 30s, films that are, you know, like shot in sort of a film noir was always an early kind of, because it's so, it's powerful, I think, with film noir. But then later I was also very inspired by naturalism, like Chris Menges stuff in, you know, in The Mission or
of course,
Killing Fields, right? That kind of cinematography, or Vilmos Zsigmond had a great range on different kinds of, you know, very different types of films, but where he was very sensible with the how he used the camera and could tell stories, I think, beautifully. But obviously, I think also Sven Nykvist, and I worked actually with his Sven Nykvist gaffer, Uffe Björk, who was the gaffer on like Fanny and Alexander, lots of Swedish films with Sven. And he was a great inspiration, actually. I think of him a lot for his simplicity in how he thinks about lighting, where he thought about lighting. And same with Sven, right? He was very, he thought like always about that there's only one sun, so there should only be one light, ideally. I think the same way. I feel like there is one light. One light is enough, right? Like you need to shape the image with a broad stroke with one light, and then you can add, but you should still feel like it's one sun. It shouldn't feel like there's 10 suns. You could obviously have practicals and stuff, but in general. Then I later on, I was in film school. It was in the 90s. I was very, very, you know, I looked up a lot to lots of cinematographers there in the 90s. Like, yeah, I mean, there's so many. It's so hard to point. But I feel like I feel like very influenced by many different ones. I think Chris Doyle is an amazing cinematographer. I think Doris Conji is an amazing cinematographer. I think, I mean, there's so many that are still around that always have influenced me a lot. And to dare, I think what inspires me, someone like Doris Conji, for example, inspires me a lot, actually, I must say, because he really works as well with what the script needs. Like he bases his work on the script and the director's vision, right, and doesn't necessarily you know, project his a specific look on things, but he's starting there and then it develops into something. And obviously he has a beautiful taste and a beautiful, really great craftsman. So
do you know your next project?
Yes, I'm working right now with Noah Baumbach on a film.
Fantastic.
That,
that may be different from the last few projects you've done.
Yeah, but that's always, I mean, it's so much about like the discussions with directors, and hopefully every project, you know, doesn't look like the other ones. So it's like, I think this was a very inspiring script that he has, and I think it feels really exciting to start.
What is it, or is it under wraps what it is?
I think, I don't know. I don't know if I talk about it too much. I don't know actually if I can talk about it, so I better not.
That's okay. I think that's our time. Please keep doing this beauty and ugly that you're doing, because it's really magic, and you're going to be such an inspiration for the next cinematographers coming up. Thank you so much for taking the time with me as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to Linus Sandgren. Saltburn will be streaming globally on December 22nd on Prime Video. And thank you so much for joining us. Pop Culture Confidential is a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, and you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
Science, science, science! Science, science! Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes, yes! Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.